This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. After the success of Rock Auk this month, it is a good time to catch up with Gachung, Stephen Blanchett, who dreamed of having a festival like this years ago. Hi, Steve. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, hello, everyone. Gachung here, a.k.a. Stephen Blanchett. Super happy to be sharing, and I'm so proud of Rock Auk and everything that happened with that. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, we have a lot of things to talk about, including some of the other things you're involved with. But let's start with a Rock Auk wrap-up. What kind of feedback did you receive about the festival, the inaugural Rock Auk Festival?
The inaugural festival was a huge success. We had folks tuning in from all over the world. It was amazing. It was so great because we had a chat session that was going along on as the concert was being streamed. And we had such amazing comments from people just sharing about how proud they are that, you know, being able to see and hear Indigenous music. I mean, it was just like brought people together. There was viewing parties that were happening in villages and communities. I mean, one of the things I'm most happy about is that, like, the small villages, they came out and really supported this. It was huge.
Everything you had hoped it would be?
And more. It really went beyond our expectations. You know, putting on a digital concert and a festival is pretty hard. You know, I've been a part of a few of these, and I've watched several of them with my friends, and it's a tough way to really communicate and really share what's the magic of, like, live music. But I really felt like our team, with KTOO and the folks that were working on the production, and Betsy doing sound, it all came together. It really captured the magic.
And how are you yourself feeling now that the first Rock Auk is behind you?
You know, it was like a few days afterwards, it felt like I had just climbed Mount Juno several times. You know? I was completely beat up, sore, hurting, you know. But it was so worth it. I wasn't expecting how emotional I was going to get just watching it. I mean, both nights, there was this grown man here just crying, just watching this beautiful thing unfold. And we're already, you know, talking about 2023. That's where we're at right now.
That was going to be my next question. The next one will be in 2023. Hopefully it will all be live and in person. And I was going to ask if you have already started planning for that, or if you're going to take a little breather first.
I thought we were going to take a little breather, but I think we're so excited about it that we're actually just trying to, like, figure out what went well, what didn't work out, and kind of the learning lessons and what's, you know, thinking of the next step. So we're doing that right now. And I think we'll take a little break after that. But all this energy and momentum that we have on closing out this inaugural event is, we're doing that as we speak. And I think, you know, even tomorrow we have another meeting. Mm-hmm. But we're just, you know, I think once we do that and get all those things in order, we'll take a breather, and then at some point in 2022, maybe in like a couple months, we'll start writing those grants again.
I can understand why there would still be quite a lot of inertia. It only wrapped up a couple weeks ago, and it was really exciting, and it was a big success. And so good to keep that going while you can and talk about those things while it's still fresh, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and just to really, like, celebrate, you know, it's those moments, like, you just celebrate it and just really take it all in, and then you move on to the next thing.
Always good to take time to celebrate a success. So when I was watching Rock Auk and I saw the first act, I believe it was Air Jazz, come on stage at Centennial Hall, I geeked out because Yada Chun was the backdrop, and it's going to be permanently installed this week on the Seawalk, on the waterfront. What is your connection to that sculpture?
Well, that was awesome. That CARES Act funding that we got from the CBJ had, you know, at the time I was working at the JAC, and we were tasked to just to basically organize and facilitate this artist grant program through the CARES funding. And the biggest project and one of the most fun ones that I was helping out on was Yada Chun with Robert Mills. And so just seeing it from just the pieces of aluminum in the beginning and to where it is now, and to have it part of the stage, that was just a magic. You know, one of those things about the festival is that there was a lot of different things that just happened, like little mistakes or things that were just pushed off that became magic, right? from Yadachu not being installed, but being installed like just a week and a half later. You know, it could have been the week before, and we wouldn't have had that beautiful art piece created by Robert on the stage. To our sound design, our lighting designer, who was here for Perseverance Theater and just happened to be here, and just phenomenal. The artistic direction that she gave with the lighting made Yadachun look so beautiful on that stage.
It was really the perfect backdrop. I got so excited when I saw it. I've seen it around town in two different places, and then to see it on stage, I was just like, it just seemed so perfect. How did it come to be as part of the backdrop? You said it hadn't been installed yet, and I think the last place I saw it was in the Centennial Hall lobby. So were you guys just like, hey, let's put it on stage?
Yeah, we were like thinking about the backdrop, and I was like, what about the canoe? That's going to look stunning lit up. And everyone's like, oh, we don't know if it's where it's going to be. But as we got a little closer, like, we have it. And so that was a key, because we were just like, it's like one of those things is when you're thinking about a festival, it's usually not, you know, I've done a lot of festivals and the backdrop is usually just the stage, right? But we had to really make this experience for the people watching it and virtually. So it had to be visually stunning. And the stage plot was a key to making that experience for the audience online to have that beautiful experience. So it was like I said, it was like all these beautiful things that just meant to be, and it happened. So yeah, when we made that decision and we had the two I want to call them the ancestors that were flanking to each side of the canoe, that were just kind of watching over, and those were beautiful button blankets that are used for dancing, and we had masks that were made by Abel Ryan that were adorning those, and then cedar bark hats. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it was a very meaningful selection, and I was excited to see it. But maybe we should back up a little bit. If people don't know what Yadachun is, or what is the story behind it, how would you describe it for folks who don't, who are maybe hearing about it for the first time?
I'd say this is a very stylistic, very creative representation of dugout canoes from the Southeast, and Robert Mills really took that vision of what would a canoe look like if it was like the bones of a canoe, right? These, like this, you know, like if you think of things that have souls, you know, we think of like, you know, this body and the bones and all that. But, you know, it was like, it's about 20 feet long, and it's has these ornate designs of form line that are baked in within the shape of it. And also if you look really closely, like if you look at the paddle, they're just etched into the paddle, these beautiful form line designs. And so it was just this representation of like how we are in this journey together during COVID, of like all of us are in this together. We are all paddling in this one canoe. It's not a partisan thing. It's not, you know, blue, it's not red, it is we're in this together. And that was the message, that one of the messages that Robert was really trying to instill, which is one of those think it values, of us paddling and us together as a strength.
Yeah, it's big, it's aluminum, it's three-dimensional form line, it's very, very striking. And now it's going to be in its permanent home. It will be installed on Zanta Kahini, I believe, but I'm not sure exactly where. Do you know anything about the installation that's happening this week?
Yeah, so if you think about where the whale park is, you know, and where the whale is, and there's that boardwalk that goes along the wall or along the shoreline, it is on the other side of that boardwalk, placed right there. So it'll be prominently seen. It's going to be beautifully lit. I think it's going to be a striking just seeing when you look out into the water, that it just, in addition to that, like, beautiful whale just breaching out of the water, then just a little bit further is this gorgeous canoe.
Oh, I can't wait to see it. I have enjoyed seeing it around town, but I really was hoping it would go on display in a more prominent location, you know, someday. So I'm happy to hear that's happening. Well, thank you for talking about that, for telling us about Yarachun, and we'll be looking for it to come up later on this week. Shifting gears a little bit, more congratulations for you are in order, as you are one of the 15 recipients of a new Native Arts and Culture Foundation grant worth $100,000, half to you, half to your partner organization. I understand this is also an idea that's been a long time in the making. So would you please tell us more about your project?
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. Yeah, this, I can't even tell you. I'm just blown away by how this year has turned out. You know, last year was such a tough year. You know, we weren't able to perform together and all that. We're starting to be able to do that now. I'm get together with my crew and my with my band, and to have Rock Ock come together. And then on top of it, this amazing support for my work. One of the things that maybe a lot of people don't know is that I'm a traditional dancer, and traditional singing and dancing was the basis of my group, of my band Bumiwa. And that was my first love. And so I've been teaching dance and choreography, song creation for just as long as I've been, actually even longer than the band. So one of the communities I've been performing or doing that is the community of Old Harbor. So Old Harbor is my organizational partner, and together we got support from the Native Arts and Cultures Foundation. I have to give them a huge thank you. Thank you to that crew for supporting all of us artists, including Lily Hope, and there's four Alaskans. And so you know, I love the continuation of our traditions, and that's what this grant's all about, to build the capacity of singers and song choreographers, you know, song composers on the island of Kodiak.
And so I understand that Bamiwa even has the name, its origin is a dance term. Is that right?
It is. Yeah. It's, that's why, I mean, really, it's like, honestly, the whole basis of our music is based on dancing. So Bamiwa means encore, do it again.
Yes. So tell me a little bit about how you, what this project entails and how your partner organization and you will be supporting each other throughout this. What are some of the stages? I believe it's a 2-year grant. Is that right?
It is. Yeah, yeah. It's a 2-year grant. I'll be traveling to Kodiak Island every 2 months. On weekends, I'll be convening a cohort of folks that are wanting to learn. We're gonna be pulling people from the 7 different communities, the indigenous communities on the island, and we're gonna be meeting bi-monthly, and we're gonna get together and work on these work on creation of songs and dances. So if everything goes to plan, and you know, which we're coming up on our first convening that will be happening, where we're getting together. We're just now getting our folks, our language experts, our 14 people that will be partaking on this from the 7 communities. If that happens, we'll have 70 new dances and songs on the island of Kodiak in the end of two years. And it really is, I mean, this community is like, I think there's maybe about 20-something traditional songs that are still in the memory that are being done on a regular basis. So this is going to increase their songs and dances on the island by so much more. It's really going to be like what the name of this grant is. It's really going to be a shift for them.
Right. It sounds like it's part revitalization, part innovation. So drawing from the past and building for the future and keeping it going. Tell me the name of the project again.
Jumilatstun, like our ancestors.
Right. Is that what you think the vision is too, bringing the past and the present together to move forward?
Yeah, well, you know, it is, right. We're honoring the past, right? Tjumilatstun was actually the original dance group that started this revitalization effort back in the 80s. So 1980, about the mid 80s, a dance group called Tjumilatstun, like our ancestors, was convened. And so that group is still around, you know, in a way, but we're just growing what they first built and what they first started. So in the end of the 2 years, we will be convening a dance festival. So those of you start planning, save your money, head over to Kodiak in June of 2024. And so we're going to have an amazing, or 23, we're going to have an amazing dance festival on the island of Kodiak, the second one on the island in any living person's memory.
Well, it certainly sounds like you have lots to look forward to over the next couple of years and lots to do to keep you busy. So, Gachung, thank you so much for talking with me today and catching up with us about everything that's happened so far and everything that you're planning to do moving forward. It's been really, really fun chatting with you.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And thank you, everyone who supported Rock Auk. And thank you so much.
Enjoy basking. Till next time. Another Juneau artist has received a Transformative Change and Indigenous Arts Award from the Native Arts and Culture Foundation. When we come back, how Lily Hope plans to use her grant. Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Along with Gachung, Chilcat weaver Lily Hope is one of 15 people to win a $100,000 SHIFT Award. The Transformative Change and Indigenous Arts Award is a new program from the Native Arts and Culture Foundation. Hope is mentoring weavers and addressing Indigenous land sovereignty in her project and will split the funds with her partner organization, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. I recently had the opportunity to sit down with Lily Hope and find out more about her project. Hi, Lily.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for talking with me today. Would you please tell me about the grant that you were recently awarded by Native Arts and Culture Foundation?
Yes, this is a new grant with Native Arts and Cultures Foundation. They have shifted to a SHIFT program, supporting Indigenous artists, elevating Native issues and voice. The actual wording is SHIFT, Transformative Change, and Indigenous Arts. My project is protecting the material sovereignty of our Indigenous homelands.
The grant will be split between yourself and your partner organization, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. So what is the connection between your work and the Gold Belt mission?
Well, a Gold Belt mission is similar actually to NACF in supporting Indigenous arts, supporting Native peoples in language, in culture, in all that we do, with Gold Belt, with an emphasis on engaging youth. So that's going to be a large part of what the work that we're doing together. And my work is to find someone to fill my shoes, but also to navigate the climate change and hunting restrictions that we have here in Southeast Alaska with the cedar stands that are freezing to death, essentially, and the mountain goat that we can only hunt during a short window of time with a smaller volume of hair.
As you just referenced, one part of your new project will focus on raising awareness about the issues around mountain goat hunting and also cedar tree conservation. Would you please say some more about that?
Thanks. The issue is that we have been making Chilcat dancing blankets for hundreds of years using mountain goat hair and cedar bark, two very accessible materials, or I shouldn't say very accessible, but they are traditional materials available to us in our backyard. We can walk up the mountainside, you know, get some goat meat to eat and use the hair as we do wherever you go in Alaska with Indigenous peoples, that we use the whole animal, right? It's pretty difficult to hunt a mountain goat. That's one thing. But the other part is that we are allowed to hunt in the fall time before our mountain goats have built up a winter bulk of hair, which means we have to kill more goats to get the same volume of hair that we would have gotten if we killed a single or two in the springtime. So my hope is that we can negotiate with the powers that be to allow us an indigenous hunting rights outside of our Department of Fish and Game parameters.
And so in addition to changing the rules of mountain goat hunting, there is also cedar tree conservation. And is that also due to the acquisition of materials for your artwork?
It is. We spin cedar bark into the warp, right? The core of our work, we weave over cedar bark and mountain goat, or used to be mountain goat. We're using a lot of merino. But yes, we need cedar bark for the structure of our warps, right? So that we can create curvilinear form line shapes, circles, and our fibers don't crush in on themselves. The issue was brought to my attention a couple of years ago by a friend, Shabadrang Khalsa, who was taking an environmental science class out at the university here in Juneau. And she brought it to my attention that there are cedar stands within walking distance of Juneau, but it's like a pretty steep terrain. You almost want to use climbing ropes over by Thunder Mountain. And she said that her team went out there, her class went out there, and found that the underbrush of the cedar stands isn't growing the same way it used to. So the roots of the trees are freezing to death, essentially. Mm. And because of the difficulty of the terrain, what can we do as humans is my question. What can we do to, you know, are we going to helicopter bales of hay up? Are we going to insulate the roots? Is this a thing that we need to be protecting, right? That we're going to physically participate in insulating the roots of these trees? And is this going to happen every year? Where's the money going to come from if that's the case? Or are we taking a different route and looking at what are the replacements of cedar bark? If we can't, if in the next 100 years our cedar trees are gone, what is a possible substitute? What does that look like? And as Indigenous peoples, we've always been resourceful, right? If we can't find it in our backyard, we'll trade across the border. We'll go down into the Cascade Mountains. We've been trading, you know, there's Tlingit potatoes that are 10,000 years old, right? They came out of South America. So we have been trading long distances for a very long time. Is there another tree or another source where our trees are not freezing to death that we can access our yellow cedar?
That's very interesting. What would be your preferred outcome if you could wave a magic wand?
I'd love to continue to use yellow cedar. It feels like home. It feels like the work we've been doing for thousands of years. But I'm acutely aware of how much we've already adapted to the changes in the world because we have the means to do so. Because our trading is so much more accessible now. We don't have to travel for 2 weeks to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. How do we have a foot in both worlds and navigate that and continue to produce work that's meaningful?
It seems to me that a lot of your livelihood is dependent on grants, and that you spend a lot of time writing grants to secure finances so you can continue to work as an artist full time. That seems like a full time job in and of itself. It seems like an art form of its own. How do you feel about working in a field that's sort of set up like that?
It is really challenging to recognize that the making of art is only like 20% of my time. And that the best artists in the world that we can still like call back on always had a team of support behind them. They had someone making their meals, they had somebody watching their kids, and it could have been the wife or the husband, right? They had someone prepping their canvases. They had a patron who was saying, hey, here's a sum of money to pay you for the next 6 months. I want first dibs on your next paintings, right? I mean, it has changed a lot. And then the whole like social media marketing thing and getting your work out there. but I have to keep this mantra going that being an artist does not equate being poor. And I'm willing to do the work and stay up until 2 a.m. and figure out what my support team looks like so that I can change that 15 to 20% art making to like 60 or 70% art making. And I can say, hey, while I'm sitting here and my hands are moving, can you craft this social media post for me? And hiring a photographer, that has been life-changing. I mean, career-changing.
The other part of your project will focus on mentorship. Who are the weavers that will be learning from you?
That isn't public knowledge yet.
I see.
There are a couple weavers who have pretty much proven themselves in self-drive. And I'll say that that is one of the top things that I look for now in apprentices. Those two weavers are working every day in the art form in Chilkat, and I'm excited to partner with them.
So how does this award, this grant, rank among some of the other accolades you've received in your career?
It is the largest dollar value grant that I've ever received, which I'm so grateful for, to have the support to continue doing the work. It's blowing my mind, and I spontaneously break into gratitude tears on the regular.
Well, apart from your partner agency, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, who are some other groups you're hoping to work with as you move through the stages of this project?
You know, I keep thinking about Chilkat and Ravenstail Weaving in the bigger sense of the world textile art. So I have my eye on like the Mid-Atlantic Fiber Association here in the US. I am hoping to partner with museum in Scotland or the British Museum in London. I've got world sites, and I feel like the grant itself is going to help to secure those partnerships. But the bigger goal, not just exposure of climate change and hunting restrictions and getting someone to fill my shoes because I won't be in the physical realm forever, but it's really to get people thinking about Chilkat and Ravenstail Weaving as present day, made today art. That this isn't 200 years ago, this isn't 10,000 years ago, we are here. We are still weaving these ceremonial objects. And hopefully I get to live long enough to see that, where people can come back and they look at a Chilkat dancing blanket and say, whoa, I know what that is. I know where they're made, and I know that they're still being made. So yes, I'm hoping to make it global. Let's go global.
I just thought of another question going back to the mountain goats and the cedar. Were these materials available in abundance, or did past weavers also have to adapt or exchange or substitute one material for another if there was a scarcity or a lack?
Great question. When we look at the old Chilkat dancing blankets, they had a higher volume of cedar bark than what we're using now, because we're mostly using merino wool in place of mountain goat. We're using like a dental floss thin strip of cedar bark, because merino is so much easier to get than climbing up a cliff and getting some yellow cedar. So the ratio was completely flipped on its head, that the Chilkat dancing blankets, the warps of them were like 80% bark and 20% mountain goat hair. So we didn't really need a full 7 mountain goat hides to make a Chilkat dancing blanket. So we kind of flipped that over now that we have easier access to merino. And we have always been resourceful in recognizing that these are slow art forms, right? So the records, the ethnographic records, show that we send mountain goat inland to our Tlingit Haida Tsimshian relatives inland, like over the mountain range, Atlin, BC. And we'd send it to them and say, hey, process this, send it back to us as warp. And even send bark with it, and they would send us the warp back so that we could focus on the weaving of the blankets.
Have you yourself been involved, personally involved, directly involved in mountain goat hunting?
I have yet to hunt a mountain goat, no. And I know that it is more than a one-person job to bring the mountain goat meat and the hide down the mountain, because the hide itself can be 30 pounds.
What are some of the challenges you foresee as you complete your projects?
Accessibility and sheer volume of hours of processing the work. Not just getting the hide off the mountain, but how many hours are we going to spend fermenting the hide and then hand pulling it off of the hide and then brushing it, washing it, carding it, like all the things. And that's where my question is of, is it necessary? Is it the best cultural step forward? Is it mandatory for us to continue to use mountain goat? If it is going to add twice, if it's going to double our workload, and we're already paid half as much as carvers and painters, what's the benefit of returning to mountain goat? Or is it actually better to find some more easily sourced, similar, really fluffy, you know, cashmere-like hair? I don't know. Those are the questions we want to answer is, you know, why? Why did they shift away? Why? And if we can't secure the goats that we need, what is the alternative? And if we choose not to, fly up the insulation for our trees, what is the alternative? Is there one?
Do you expect pushback or resistance from some of the bureaucracies that you'll have to engage with?
I don't anticipate a lot of pushback. I think of myself as a pretty decent negotiator and or listener. And I believe in the goodness of people, and that when we're asking for things, we're really expanding our relationships as we move through this work. So I feel like Terry Rothkar has already built a relationship, and that the precedent has been set for her and a couple of other hunters in Sitka, Alaska, to go up and get these goats. So I feel like it'll be kind of like picking up where my clan sister left off. Hopefully. I'm hopeful. I'm Lily Hope, and I'm hopeful.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Tomorrow afternoon, Southeast Senior Services continues with their caregiver education series with a talk about estate planning and long-term care plans. Welcome back to the show, Denny Darby, family support advocate. Hi, Denny.
Hi.
And Beth Chapman, attorney at Faulkner Banfield, featured speaker for the session of this series. Hello, Beth.
Hello.
Beth, let's start with you. Would you please introduce yourself and tell us about your connection with Southeast Senior Services?
So my name is Beth Chapman. I'm an attorney at Faulkner Banfield here in Juneau. And for the past 30 plus years, I have been practicing in the area of estate planning and elder law care, working with many seniors throughout Southeast Alaska on ensuring that they have the proper documents in place for the eventual need for care if that were to occur. And my connection with Southeast Senior Services is really that many of my clients will use their services as well. So when they asked me to speak on this topic, I was more than willing to help.
You said one of your specialties is it elder care law?
Elder law, right.
Elder law.
It's called elder law.
How did you get into that?
Well, I really enjoy working with families to help solve problems. And so that's an area of expertise that flows from working on wills and powers of attorney and really helping families determine how to put a care plan in place. And really a lot of it is how to pay for that long-term care if that were to occur. So I sort of just fell into it, decided it was interesting, and I really do enjoy working with the families and helping to solve problems for them.
Now, we all logically know that it's important to make these decisions and put care plans in place well before we need them for the future care of ourselves and our loved ones. But what are some of the reasons that people don't do this?
Well, I think a lot of people don't do it because they don't want to face the inevitability that they may die or that there may be a need for assistance. A lot of people don't do it because they just keep putting it off. But, you know, the majority of people do put these documents in place. And many of these documents, particularly powers of attorney and healthcare directives, are readily available, mostly through Alaska Legal Services and their website, as well as other places. So I think most people do get them in place, and those that don't just don't want to face it.
Well, maybe in the session, that'll be something that you will address, what you would say to someone who is reluctant or hesitant or having some fears there. There's another legal aspect to this talk as well, and that's having the bases needed covered for caregivers. What are some examples of that? What do you mean by that?
So for caregivers, what we really want to do is make sure that they have the legal authority that they're going to need to implement the care plan. So if we're working with a family and we have a parent, for example, that is incapacitated and unable to make financial decisions, we need to know that we have legal authority for the caregiver, if that's a, and we're talking family caregivers here, so I'm going to clarify that, that the family caregiver has the ability to make the financial decisions, to pay the bills, to access the bank accounts as needed. Similarly, we need to be concerned that they have the authority to make healthcare decisions. And those are why those documents are so critical, because without them, the only recourse may be to go to court and obtain a guardianship or a conservatorship, which is, of course, a court proceeding to gain authority to make decisions on behalf of somebody who may need assistance.
Sounds like it would be much easier to do all that in advance and not get to that point.
It is much easier. And as I always like to say, you make the decisions, you're controlling the decisions, and you don't have a court possibly appointing, if you have several children, for example, the child you may not have wanted if you were in the if you had the ability to choose.
Denny, who do you think should attend this session? Is there a particular group of people that might be in need of this information right now?
Oh, honestly, I think out of all of our sessions, this is probably the session that anybody of any age would find benefit from, because wills and estates and taking care of that sort of part of your life can never, you know, if you're a young adult, and I mean, there, let's say you got a life insurance policy, and making sure that that goes to the, you know, having some kind of directives written down if you should die. So for anybody any age, I think that this is really going to be a valuable resource, particularly in what I do every day, and the people that call the resource center and the caregivers that I deal with. What Beth said is so true. So many people, they just don't want to face that this is happening, and that they have put it off and put it off. And sometimes people find themselves the age that they are, and they're actually quite amazed. They're kind of like, I can't believe I'm this age, and so I really need to take care of this. They you know, they kind of, life just has a way of getting away on people. And then oftentimes, you know, with their parents or themselves or their spouse, they don't have things in place. And then, as Beth said, they're coming from a reactionary point of view rather than from being proactive. And it creates just a whole different, creates a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, possibly bad feelings between people, when if you had all this laid out, all of that would be done, and then there wouldn't be all this other side stuff going on, and people can focus on really taking care of the elder.
Anything to add to that, Beth?
No, I think, you know, Denny really hit the high points there. The powers of attorney and advanced healthcare directives are two of the most essential documents that all of us should have. Once you're 18, nobody can make your decisions for you unless you grant them that authority. There's a few exceptions under the healthcare directive, but as a general rule, these documents are essential for everyone. And what they do is they have in place your plan, who will make your decisions when you really need that assistance. And the assistance could be a temporary moment where you need assistance. For younger people, that can happen, even if you know they have an accident, they're even out of the country, they may need somebody to make that decision for them. Or it can be what we call more of a long-term power of attorney and healthcare directive for elders or for people who are suffering from a disability and are unable to make their own decisions. They will last potentially for their entire life. And as I always like to tell my clients, you know, you want to make the decisions. You don't want somebody making them for you.
Well, it is a good thing you're presenting this information, and it sounds like it's going to be a great resource for anyone who attends. So that's tomorrow, Wednesday, November 17th at 4 p.m. It's online, Legal Planning for Caregivers, and past recordings are available if you missed the two previous sessions. Denny, how can we find those?
Okay, on our Facebook page, on the Catholic Community Services Facebook page, if you pull up the page and then look to on the left-hand side of the screen under videos, you will see the last two. If you can't make it to the live webinar but want to see the recorded, you have to wait till after the webinars finish tomorrow, and then the recording is put up on Facebook. And it will also be a YouTube video too. And if people want to attend live, they can go to our Facebook page at ccsak.org and then click on the Caregiver Education Series 2021. And you will go through the prompts to attend live.
Will there be an opportunity to ask some questions for with Beth?
Yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of questions. I mean, this is kind of a nuts and bolts issue that people tend to, when it's offered, they tend to prick up their ears and they have a lot of interest. Yeah.
And Denny, in one of the last times we talked, you mentioned that you're also holding some practice sessions for seniors who might need a little help logging on. Are
yeah,
you doing any more of those?
Yeah, we've been offering them every Friday, but we haven't had any takers so far. I'm wondering if we underestimated our clientele and everybody's better at logging in than we thought. But we really get a lot of people that go to the Facebook page. If they don't attend personally, there's a lot of people looking at the Facebook page.
Wow, perhaps better to have it and not need it. Well, Denny and Beth, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks again for doing what you do, for presenting this caregiver education series. I really enjoyed learning all about it every week, and it sounds like you've got another great presentation coming up tomorrow with Beth. So thanks again today for your time and for sharing all that information.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Have a great afternoon.
Bye.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. The first annual Dan Austin Memorial Clothing Drive is now underway and will run through December 6th. Joining us now to tell us more about that, Alexis Miller, Clothing Drive Coordinator. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. And Luke Roman, Deputy Director for the Glory Hall. Hello, Luke.
Hey there. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for being here. For those who don't know, could you please tell us about Dan Austin? Maybe Alexis will start with you.
Yeah, I actually first met Dan Austin. We were both legislative aides in the Alaska State Legislature, and I'm going to age myself by saying that was in the 90s. But Dan worked for Kay Brown, and I probably was working at that time for Johnny Ellis, both Anchorage legislators. So I met Dan then, but I was raised Catholic. So when Dan took over, gosh, I don't even know when, but he spent more than 20 years as the general manager of St. Vincent de Paul out there in the valley, and he passed away in 2018, as a lot of people know, and he just did amazing things. Someone compared him to, they called him Mother Teresa of Southeast Alaska, but maybe Father Teresa or whatever of Southeast Alaska, but he was just one of the kindest men I have ever met. So humble, and when he got sick with cancer, he didn't even let people know. He just kept on working until he couldn't work any longer, and he passed away on July 25th, 2018. So I just thought it was appropriate to name this clothing drive after Dan, since I knew him.
Got it. And this clothing drive is focused on warm clothing for the unsheltered during cold weather. What is the need for that in our community? Luke, maybe you'd be the best person to answer this.
Sure. So I'm the deputy director at the Glory Hall, which I believe you already said. But so the need for further shelter for people experiencing homelessness is very great. Even though we have this new beautiful facility out in the valley with 43 sleeping spaces and private sleeping spaces and 21 overflow sleeping spaces, we are still full, so full. And so there are, unfortunately, individuals walking around town all night, all day with nowhere to go, especially if they're individuals that for whatever reason can't get a vaccination. And so the need is there. The need is definitely there.
Alexis, what would you add?
Well, I just want to add that I grew up in Juneau. I lived downtown on Gold Street, right behind the Baranoff Hotel. Since I was 3 years old, I've been in Juneau. I was born in Fairbanks, but I go out and walk every single day, and I live near the Federal Building now in a condo, and I see homeless people on a regular basis. They actually are in, you know, makeshift shelters, and sometimes, unfortunately, on property that they're not supposed to be on. And, you know, whenever I can, I encourage them to go to the new warming center, which just opened last night at the Resurrection Lutheran Church. But, you know, I've been seeing homeless people for decades, and it breaks my heart. And that's part of the reason that I was inspired to do this. On Friday, October 22nd, in the Juneau Empire, I read a piece by Laura Roram, R-O-R-E-M. Her husband was a pastor, Larry Roram, and she's a member of the Resurrection Lutheran Church, but she had a daughter who was chronically homeless and also suffered with some severe mental illness issues and passed away in 2018 as well. But Laura's last paragraph on her piece here, Seeking Justice for People Experience Homelessness, says, "Working for justice with and for homeless people is doing God's will. May we overcome our discomfort and answer his call to action." And for me, that was like, that's my call to do something, because I can. I have the ability to organize events just from my professional background, my years working in the Alaska legislature, running political campaigns. And I just thought, you know, I want to see people being able to go to a warming center like they could previously at the Jack, which was open all the time. Now it's just at night, and I'm not really sure what the difference is, because we're still all in a pandemic and people just need a warm place to go. Thank God for the new Glory Hall facility. But yeah, it's heartbreaking to me when I see people who live outdoors and it's so cold right now. So I know that there's such a desperate need, and you know, we're looking for any, you know, type of winter clothing. I'm talking about jackets and gloves and hats and scarves and even boots, but we'd really like things to be relatively new. And we definitely, because of the pandemic, are stressing if they're clothing items, please wash them or please dry clean them before you drop them off. And this clothing drive will not only benefit the new Glory Hall, and Luke can talk more about that in a moment, and it will also benefit St. Vincent's. They now have a Dan Austin Center named after Dan Austin, as well as Smith Hall Senior Housing. And then this will also benefit the warming center at the Resurrection Lutheran Church, those three places.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure folks know what they can donate and where they can donate it. So can you give us a rundown on what's needed most, what else is being accepted, and how we can make those donations, where we can make them?
I think Luke, since he's right there on the front lines with 64, I believe, folks that are staying there at the Glory Hall.
64, yes.
He can talk about that.
Okay, so we're looking for all sorts of winter clothing items, snowsuits, coats, hats, gloves, scarves, like Alexis said.
Adult sizes, or men's or women's or children?
adult sizes, men's and women's. I don't think we'll turn away children's sizes. The Glory Hall doesn't work too much with children, but we can route those items to proper, you know, places that can give them out to children. Mm-hmm. And they can be dropped off. We'll have a drop-off bin here at the Glory Hall at 8715 Teal Street in the Valley at our new location. We are open every day from 7 a.m. until 9:30 p.m. and anyone can just drop off that stuff whenever. There's also going to be a drop-off bin at the Dan Austin Center at St. Vincent de Paul, also on Teal Street, and a drop-off bin at the new warming shelter, which is at the Resurrection Lutheran Church in downtown Juneau. And I'm not absolutely sure of their address, but it's the Brown Church in the Flats.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're right on the corner of West 9th, I believe, or West 10th. I have it right here. 740 West 10th Street.
Very easy to find. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Let me just give my phone number and my full name again. It's Alexis. Ross is my middle name. My last name, Miller. And my cell phone is 907-793-0701. People can call me. And Luke can give his contact information.
Sure. My name is Luke. My last name is Vroman. And my email address here at the Glory Hall is Luke, L-U-K-E, like my first name, at feedjuno, F-E-E-D, Juno spelled out, .org. Luke at feedjuno.org. Feel free to contact me.
Well, Luke and Alexis, I just want to thank you so much for doing this for our community. Thank you for organizing this warm clothing drive. And I'm glad we were able to help you spread the word here on Juno Afternoon today.
Thank you very much.
And take care.
And thank you to the community. Thank you.
Yes. Thanks. Have a great one.
You too.